by 1971,
before you get to 71.
Yeah.
I know you're talking to me. I want you to be just as precise and accurate as you can be about the year 62 to 65. What function do you think I performed for the institution?
Mm-hmm.
And what problems do you think I faced?
Well, I think that was a very crucial, difficult period of time because at least three different reasons. One was that with the publicity, some of which was good in the sense it got the governor interested in the campus, but some of which is not good because any publicity, basically my old theory, that doesn't always sound good, doesn't necessarily help you. So there was just that problem of getting over a difficult period. Secondly, there were lots of difficulty within the campus. You had essentially a split campus. I'm not talking about how numerically divided up. There's the fact that matters, I think, what Hamilton and Porter realized, much to their chagrin, when they came down, they had misread the situation. They made a great blunder. Harry Porter was to tell me this subsequently. Because when I was pushed out of the arts and science thing because they wanted to reach and alter that whole administrative structure. They thought they could go back to the earlier system, the visualized structure. They thought that they could have a homophobe that was just simply, you know, quieting the majority of the faculty. They thought the majority of the faculty was prepared to turn the clock back, and it turned out not to be the case. That night, when Hamilton came and the votes in the faculty floor came all one after another, in effect censuring Hamilton, take a forthright action. The votes were not there in supporting their action.
Wait a minute, what was, this is new material. What were the votes about?
Arnie Fine would be good. He was involved right there. They were essentially about approval, disapproval of the actions taken by the chancellor, by Hamilton. And they, Dick Morse was kind of acting as chairman of facts at that time. He eventually went up to Yale,
in
the history. And it was clear from the start, the end of the meeting. As a matter of fact, that very night, I think it was, that word had gotten out, though, that an editorial was going to appear in the Times supporting what Lee had represented in that press conference, the education editor at the time, was going to write a piece.
Benjamin Fine?
No, that was there was a piece that was going to support the campus. So during that evening, those meetings, it was a meeting at which Arnie Feingold got up and offered his resignation as graduate dean in protest that he had not been consulted about the change in administration, my position, and so on. And that not only angered him, but people in science, as I remember, they felt that this high-handed, this authoritarian action. That evening,
you were academic dean.
I was dean of arts and sciences.
Dean of arts and sciences.
And Harry Porter, subsequently Rockefeller, ordered Hamilton to be pro tem president. And Harry Porter, pro tem head of arts and sciences, that's what Hamilton put him in charge, just for the interim. So this just backs up what I'm telling you. What had developed was a genuine split in the faculty that had been unfortunately fueled with great expectations. The losing side felt that they had the support of the central administration, thought they would have dropped them like a hot potato when they realized that the governor was breathing down there and they didn't have the majority of voice. So we then ended up with a campus that was really internally split very seriously. And the third major problem block could just get the place moving as a university. I mean, everything had ground to a halt. The whole question of, so those 3 years had to be internal, external repair job, but one repair had to get the thing moving. And I always felt that your coming at that particular time was the most important thing for the healing of the university and for gaining a certain credibility for the university, which was very crucial, because I think the publicity, as good as it was, and it got people supporting the campus, like the governor and the press and so on, still, in academia, you have to be able to attract people to institutions,
right.
And they're not going to come just because someone tells them they would like to hire them. They want to have some feeling about the future of that place, and especially when you're building a new university. So those 3 years were very crucial in giving people a sense of confidence of the future of the university, while at the same time trying to still rather troubled waters and internal difficulty. I always felt you did a remarkable job, and that was, well, just on my own personal view, I don't think that was fully appreciated, because it bordered on an impossible type job. But another interesting thing developed in that period, which I think was very important for the university, which is a very subtle thing but not known, and that was that essentially, because of the need to start building that university, genuine involvement and authority was given to chairman. That was the very interesting thing that happened to Stony Brook at the time. If you recall, we had various different groups and meetings with chairman and so on. The chairman became, because they felt this was a critical period, I think there was a cooperative spirit started to develop, and the chair people became visible, active, and I think that was one of the better periods in the history of the university, frankly, in that period of time, between 1960 and 1965, because it put in place basic departments, it put in place the leadership in those departments, it got the whole recruitment process off the ground, because it had earlier been a shambles. I mean, 62, well, Harry Potter was there for the previous to your taking over, but quite frankly, I think Harry had rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I happen to like Harry. I mean, he thanked me at one point for not kicking him, as he said, in the head after I got out of our son, because he said, you could have done blood. Instead, we became rather friendly and rather close. But I found that a lot of people on campus were very, very suspicious of him. I think the principal reason, because he was a representative from Central Ministry, and so you were able to come without that sort of compromised position, representing all of me. So for all those reasons, that was a very crucial and critical moment. Quite frankly, whether we'd make it or not, I think back that there was a series of that. So all those things combined, I think, to make it possible. See, I think when Johnny came, he already had a place that the confidence had been restored in this institution. He had chairmen in place who were essentially, by and large, pretty good, very well aware of what they had to do to build the department. It created, I think, an atmosphere that finally dissolved. Well, certain things never get dissolved in personal faith, in old conflicts, but you find dissolved, I think, the obstacles for the institution to move on through earlier harsh feelings. Don't forget, things were very rough. I mean, it was a time when people prepared for fisticuffs, you know. I mean, it was not a happy period.
What about the relations with the students?
Students, I think, I thought their relations became very... See, the trouble at Oyster Bay, to a certain extent, it was nice, it was country-like, and so on, but it was much too insular, and it was fraught with too much Well, there's a lot of manipulativeness. I mean, with all due respect to people, I think Al Vostell used his role to wind students up. He was so close politically to Olson on such a that he felt he had to use the students for that. And I think I never forgave for that. I felt that students have to be respecting their own terms. And essentially, I think what happened 62 to 65, I thought a very good student body started to develop. We started to attract, because don't forget, us today we had trouble attracting good students. Well, we didn't have the various departments in place and so on, but we were starting to get very good students. We were, in effect, becoming, as I gave in a talk to someone at Hawaii, they were the East-West Institute there, and the UNESCO co-sponsored a conference in the late 60s on what are new institutions, what have they done in recent years since the Second World War. And they had the head of the Open University there from London, they had people from, I remember, from Japan and Korea with new universities developing. And the main thing that I had to give these, I said, look, we tend to think that new universities will introduce just novelty across the board. I said, there's another very important element, and that it's very, the faculty are very interested in being accepted by their peers, and that a great stress and stressful situation is being acceptable by your peers. In Stony Brook, in that period of time, was able, I really believe, to gain that respectability professionally. That enabled us to start the good recruitment process and to begin the big growth that was to take place in the later 60s, throughout the 60s.
Right. Hold it now. I want to change the side.
I remember meeting him, and through
He had been recommended by Dick Morse. Dick Morse was an old friend of mine because Dick and I kind of grew up together at Columbia and worked together in contemporaries and so on. And I was very upset that we couldn't keep him and that he went to Yale. But the fan, I got to meet him because of Morse, and we chatted. But I don't recall that particular meeting.
Okay.
I don't recall it.
All right.
Well, and the rest, as one would say, is history. The rest we know what happened, I guess. My own involvement, as you know, I mean, I got to, I was away for the sabbatical of 2 years, 64, with the hope that we were going to bring a new development for the arts by a combination of the use of facilities in New York City and Stony Brook. John Newfield and I worked very hard on that. As I say, well, that was not to be, but we made a determined effort to build the arts. I remember going to Johnny and saying that I felt that... I was always concerned that with Johnny Strong and Alec, who early on, Johnny pulled him into his office, that there would be a, without doubt, of course there would be a strong emphasis on physical stuff. We knew that.
Yeah, on the physical sciences, right.
And I knew that would happen, but, and they immediately tried to bring Yang here. That was one of the first moves. But I was interested and concerned that we have strengths across the whole spectrum, and I argued for developing a planning for this region-wide as well as locally, and so Johnny asked me, I was in New York time, and there was some problems, I guess, because of Stan's personality. He sometimes could get brittle, and there were people that had lunch with me once in New York, said he was a little concerned, even though he had to, so he didn't want him to keep dangling midair as acting dean. That's what he had. He said that was unfair to make him dean, but he was a little nervous about it, because he rubbed different people the wrong way, and there were problems. Could I, when I came back, could I become associate or something? Because also I had these other interests, which Toll, interesting to me, said he would like to see them followed up. So we created a structure of three associate teams. We had the physical science, Len Eisenberg, myself, the humanities, arts,
Charlie Hoffman.
And Charlie Hoffman for social science. He was going to use that as... it was never clear what we were doing, really. I remember Len Eisenberg coming in one day and said, I don't even know if I should even come to the office. See, we had a little office, three of us had that. We didn't know precisely what we were supposed to do. And because Sam had that tremendous effort doing everything himself,
I'm fine, thank you. How are you? What can I do? Look, could I call you back? I've got someone here. And your number? 6535. All right, fine. I'll call you back. As I know, Brunelli.
Well, that was the situation. Then I, when Stan made an offer from Texas to go to head up the Latin American Institute.
When was that?
68.
68.
And he was, it was already, the offer was made, I think, in the winter of 67, if I recollect correctly. And he had hoped to stay on. He was very upset because, the problem was that given the range of salary that they could offer on Dean's line, he could still be a boss like that, it was not possible to give him the salary they wanted. So he had urged them to perhaps put him on a faculty line, and because we did this for people in health sciences, we're doing that. Johnny was not disposed to want to do it instead. What Johnny came up with was that whole restructuring to create for that position of arts and sciences, it would be a major unit, the vice president of liberal arts. and with provost. So each of the division heads would be called provost. But that was his idea, and it was brought before the Senate. It was finally approved. He tried to convince Stan that if he were patient, when Albany would finally approve it, and he had been sent up there, that his salary could then be made more commensurate with what the competition was offering in Texas.
But Dan wanted to stay.
I think he did. I had long talks with him. I think he wanted to stay. I think he got a message that he was not, put another way, that three key people, he felt, were not putting out as he thought they should. One was Johnny, the other was Alex, the third was Bentley. And I think he then felt that he'd be better off not to wait and see what happened, but to take a very good offer, something that also genuinely attracted him. I mean, put him in the best, perhaps, institution in the United States on Latin American studies at Austin. So it was too good an opportunity in a way, and he wanted more quick response. He felt that they weren't moving rapidly enough to push it. I don't know they weren't, but it was a mixture of things at the time. I think essentially Stan was so eager to get the thing resolved quickly. And you know, Albany, things didn't necessarily move that quickly. So he left, and then a review was made of the position as this new system was coming into play. There was a little search process. I was asked to head up the become the vice president of liberal studies, or head of arts and sciences. That was the original title. And then we started this long process trying to search for provosts or deans or heads of the division. And that was a long, drawn-out process. The different department chairs came in were at first very reluctant. They didn't want to deal with anyone but the head of RSEC. See, that they were dragging their feet. That was a not unexpected problem. And then a couple of years later, Bentley, by virtue of age, at that time the rules were that he had to step down.
That was 71.
He had to step down in 71.
He and I stepped down at the same time.
Yeah, so that then a search was set up. And it was a large search committee. It was chaired by Billy Jim Layton. It was the first major search committee, I think, on campus for a major position that included students, as well as faculty, as well as administration. I remember that Pellegrino was on it and so on. And they did search. They had different people around. At any rate, I had handled some very difficult situations in the late 60s already, things were happening. And I guess I was able to establish some kind of confidence with various faculty and students during a difficult period. So there was a lot of concern that the early 70s would not be that much different from what we were experiencing in the late 60s. That helped push it. I don't know. Whatever happened, I remember I was then appointed, or Johnny talked to me, and I said I would be very careful to review these things, because I had established good working relations with Bentley Glass during my period there. And I knew some of the concerns Bentley had had. And
he was much broader than biology in his interest.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Bentley had a broad range of interests. And essentially, one of the things about Bentley, he, I guess, felt that the independence of that office, the academic vice president, wasn't yet clearly established. And I think Alec was still sort of on that turf. Because I remember we were doing a lot of work clarifying the budget, where the funds were, where they were going, and we were acting as kind of watchdogs for the academic for Bentley, my office. A lot of problems came up, which clearly indicated that Bentley wasn't getting the full resource. You know, it was being handled in different offices outside the academic group. So when I got in, I talked with Johnny about the need to establish a genuine independent, though cooperative, role in that office. And that meant my working out with Alec. But Alec already started getting all kinds of problems he had to start there, so he lopped off a lot of the areas of responsibility he had under him at one time. And so I started in 71.
Okay. Now, from your point of view, were some of the problems that you faced, you yourself, and then what were some of the problems that Alec faced? I want to push you into detail somewhat because you're in the position to know what some of them are.
At that time, you mean like right. That in the office?
Right.
Well, I think the main problem first was to establish a clear authority for the academic sector of the university.
Yeah.
I think it was pretty unclear in some ways. We started with a highly centralized structure in those early years with Johnny coming president because everything sort of stemmed out of that office.
Yeah.
And John always, felt he wanted to be in touch with everything, regardless of what it was. That was his nature and his personality. So that tended to force a definition of areas of responsibility. And the university needed it. It was getting complex. It was getting very big. We're running enormous populations just in the academic side alone. So we started building expertise into our own operations in terms of dealing with financial matters, dealing with matters on academic planning.
How did Bill Moran?
Bill Moran worked for Alec. Alec had a small group. Gradually what happened was that operationally, Alec started cutting away more and more things that might have reported to him earlier. And what he kept around him was essentially a planning group for two purposes, physical planning for the construction, and the planning process in general, which was essentially the control of the whole budget process for the whole university. So even though the budget director was sitting over in the vice president for finance side, in Joe Danna's side, let's say, Mitch Gristel, for example, came here as budget director. He essentially was working for Joe Danna as budget director. However, he also had to deal with Alec. Alec, in effect, had become like the budget chief, if I can put it that way, of the campus. He coordinated all the arguments, the plans, and so on. Bill Moran became one of the people in a group that he wanted to develop for purpose of rational academic master planning and the continuation. He was a great believer in systems, in formulas being driving the budget and justification.
Now that was forced upon him from Albany?
Not so much Albany, but it was his own construction.
Yes,
he came up with the idea that in order to make our case known, we had to rationalize it and justify that what we were doing could be quantified in ways that would demonstrate that we were therefore in need of more support and resources than what Albany, for example, was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So two major kinds of arguments developed, which went on for years, is that the formula funding had to reflect the nature of the disciplines the campus was in, and the mix of the students that the campus had in those various disciplines. By mix, meaning all the way at the PhD level. Because many campuses had it, and they didn't have many PhD programs, so there was this great push to have as many programs on the doctoral level as we could, because that would eventually mean more support for the campus in terms of the formulas that were being developed. But there were formulas also being developed earlier. Wells from Indiana had developed so-called Wells formula, how you could formulate the rationale for support of different students from undergraduate to doctoral students in the campus. So these things already were in the works, but Alec wanted to put into use for the system in SUNY, and to our advantage, of course. In addition, we opened up communication and worked very closely with the California system, and used a lot of their information and back and forth discussions with especially with the three new campuses. New, that is, the time we came on, La Jolla, Santa Cruz, and Irvine. And we interchanged a lot of information and how they were going through that. How is La Jolla developing its library and library resources? What rationale did they use in California for that? And we adopted some, or tried to get it adopted here. those are things that we had. So actually, my office, vis-a-vis Alec, we cooperate on a number of matters very effectively. Once we understood the where the dividing lines were going to be. And Alec, more and more, I think, as the years went on, became tied more and more to Johnny in some way, rather than the independent figure. I had mixed feelings about that. I really felt that he should have been more independent in some way. I think it would have been better for everyone around, all over the place. But
certainly that was the way he was looked at from Albany.
I know.
Yeah.
And Albany always interpreted, and that's how I used to say to Alec, I thought that that was both good and bad. You see, I think it's strange, certainly, in some way. But they didn't fully appreciate him for his own kind of talent he could develop, because he was being seen merely as, many times I would, there were times on some critical issues later in Johnny's tenure in office where I was asked to act as a kind of middleman, either with Mrs. Moore or with the chancellor's office, on some disputes that developed between Johnny and either some people in the administration or on the board. And he couldn't use Alec in that because they would see Alec as simply Johnny, you know, another Johnny coming in. So I remember in a couple of cases I was trying to sort of argue Johnny's case with them without, and they knew that I was not sitting in Johnny's office. On certain things, especially with Bruce Bearing, I established very good relations with Bruce. Didn't like Johnny at all. That was a terrible kind of tension always between them. And
why not, you know?
Well, I think it started back when he was president of Binghamton. Johnny came as president of Stony Brook, and I think he felt that Johnny just overwhelmed the other president and himself included and tried to steal all the thunder for Stony Brook. I think it was always that kind of resentment. But then just personality-wise, very different. Bruce was a very soft-spoken, low-key person, a very reflective person. He came out of English Lit. Johnny was hard-driven and, you know, very aggressive in a way. And it was oil and water. But at any rate, there were times when a special argument, Johnny wanted a special salary for someone to go up, I would write the thing, go up and talk to Bruce. Because there's a better chance of we not raising a lot of noise. It would eventually get approved, but it would cut down the noise level.
What? When did the director, the vice president for personnel, who was there in the early years of
Central Administration?
Price.
Yeah,
I had a very good relationship.
No, he was a doll of a person. He was a lovely human being.
He became ill, apparently.
I guess so. I heard he got ill, and
he was responsible, really, for pushing through the whole distinguished professor concept.
Yes.
In order to get to get a case.
Right. And no, he was a remarkable guy. You're right. I mean, he would be so cooperative. I mean, if you had a reasonable case,
sure,
and you could push it. And he was a very, very shrewd man. He was a very wise man. He was very helpful to us. Very effective. As a matter of fact, what the faculty never realized here when they used to evaluate, administrate, and so on, they saw Johnny as the link to Albany, period. But the fact is that each of us had functions and roles always played on me. I have one year, I remember going over all my taxes and everything for the year, and I was checking out all my materials. One year, I made 56 trips to Albany. So it was more than one a week. And it was that was one of the requirements. But this is the way we developed, mainly with Albany. Each of us had different functions to perform in that kind of structured organization they had. And in a way, I had with Alec and Johnny, I think it could be fairly said that there was, I had enough leeway and room for the development of the academic programs. I mean, they, of course, Alec was interested in the planning point of view. Johnny, of course, from the overall university standpoint. But it was, I think, a opportunity to establish good working relations with departments without being impinged on. Johnny's interest became, well, things became more and more complex, and he had to take on a more and more political role, and it became very obvious that he had to go out and stop talking to legislators. He had to go, because after Rockefeller left, you had a much tougher job.
Right. You had no support.
No. And so his role started to change. He became more externally involved. Alec became much more the sort of the role of the president on the internal side of the campus, coordinating the various administrative services. And so I think that I saw that change in the 10 years I was serving as academic vice president.
Well, you didn't have the caliber of understanding educational, education-wise, from the or on the part of the local political representatives. They just weren't.
No.
They weren't there. They
didn't understand, and it was a major problem. And I could see the frustration building over the years, because that was a major difficulty. And in a way, ironically, because Rockefeller was so deeply committed to the whole university structure, it was both good and bad. It didn't develop enough strength, independence on the part of the campuses to learn their political kinds of lessons that they had to establish with their representatives and so on. A lot was taken for granted. So he had to turn to that a lot. And when Alec became acting president, he's spending all the time practicing on that. And that's what Burnett, like, all of his work. But I think Alec, his bitterness, I think, comes to a large extent from the fact that, quite simply, I think they felt ultimately that he was just a carbon copy of Johnny, and they didn't want to have, they were rid of Johnny, they were fine. And they didn't want to have him continue in some shape or form. And he didn't create enough of an independent image in their mind. So, a very talented person in so many ways. But I think he's a very important key to getting a larger chunks of the whole picture put together, especially how the president's office operated and how policy making was going on vis-a-vis the campus and SUNY and division of the budget and legislation. He would know that.
Do you have any insight as to the relations between Johnny and Ed Pellegrino?
Well, I was sometimes umpiring these things. Johnny would ask me to come in on Sunday meetings they would sometimes have down in his house, in the president's house. They weren't always very pleasant meetings. He wanted to not only just have a witness, but he sought someone who could kind of get along well with both sides and kind of be there to break some of the tension. It was a tense situation, I think, almost without any abatement, so far as I can recall, during those years. They have men of two very different personalities. They were both very ambitious. Ironically, many similar traits in some respects, but they saw one another in very different lights. Consequently, it was very tight. Pellegrino wanted the full range of control over his entire bailiwick. And Johnny, as president, felt that he couldn't allow that. And I think it boiled down to very simple terms. Most of the problems, I reckon, I mean, they would have to, I got along well with Ed. One of the problems also was this question of he having to report in certain ways through the acting vice president's office, appointments and so on. And we had things like where would the signatures appear? Where would they appear on the paper? If it was, if the acting was under his signature, that wasn't so good, you know. And sort of a question of putting them on the same line, you know. I mean, there were, some of these things were kinds of. But I tend to feel that Ed, basically, yes, he wants a certain amount of authority and power, but essentially, he would cooperate if he felt he wasn't about to be second-guessed, you see. I think that was a very important thing, and I think he felt that Johnny was about ready to second-guess him any time. And that's why I think the difficulty started. It wasn't that, because I could realize he would cooperate on many things that went on. As a matter of fact, cooperate, I think, was more easily accomplished with Ed, and I think later on, this is just my own personal view, than when Howie Oakes came in.
Ed had a national view.
Absolutely.
And
and he was a national figure.
Yeah.
And he knew that much, and in a way, he didn't get caught up in petty politics. I mean, I think Ed's politics was in a broader plane, and he felt that he had a certain vision of things that he wanted to cut. Not all of these things always worked out right. I mean, he felt there ought to be a separate division for humanities and social in the health sciences. I think that ultimately it was not to succeed. Because in a strange way, underneath it, Ed hungered to be a president, and because of his intellectual range of interest. Underneath, ironically, he was not fully satisfied just to be head of a health science center. I think his intellectual range went beyond it. And he had the intellectual capacity to go beyond it. So,
well, of course, he went to Catholic University,
yeah,
but didn't stay there because they asked him to raise money.
I know. I know. And that, well, you see, essentially he's an intellectual. I don't know how else to put it. He's not a fundraiser. He's not a politician in the sense of going out and trying to get people to support it. He was good in terms of his effect. He was a very persuasive guy, but he wasn't a politician in that sense. He wasn't a fundraiser. And he was an impassioned guy, believing in what he did. And he ran up against another impassioned guy who believed in what he did his way. And that wasn't easy. Also, I think there was something Ed who looked at Johnny with a certain kind of, that somehow he never had to overcome enormous difficulty, financially, socially, whatever. And I think Ed had to experience overcoming great difficulty, which Johnny did not. And I think that always...
I'm not quite...
Well, John, for one thing, Ed came from a poor family, had to work his way up the... to eventually do what he wanted to. I think he felt Johnny came from a wealthy family. He was, he never had to experience having to fight for his way or his place in the sun. And in a certain sense, he felt that Johnny was a kind of very, very lucky human being, which sometimes he almost resented that, you know. But the most important thing, I think, was just that they operate on different levels. Johnny was not essentially an intellectual in thinking out goals or respect for the university. He knew what had to be done, but he was essentially
more of a manager?
Well, manager would be the wrong term, because I'm not sure he was that good a manager. He was a builder. I think he was his excitement was a builder. And I think what most of the building capacity was fulfilled, and they wouldn't let him build more. And that's exactly what happened here. I think that was the end. He wasn't interested anymore. But Pellegrino was very much the same way. Yes, Pellegrino once said to me, I had called him up about some people over. We were keeping files, and I said, Ed, you don't send material over on certain people. They're going to back into tenure. I mean, they unless files are presented by your committees, they're going to, by default, have served beyond a number of years, and we'll be in no position to give them tenure. You want tenure for these people? He says, oh, I can't bother about these details. So I said, but Ed, you're going to be saddled with it, you know, yeah. come hell or high water, you've got to do something about it. And he said, you know, I'm really an architect. He said, I'm not a manager. I appreciate that. But, you know, in the meantime, have someone send over the papers, whatever, you know. It finally came, but we had to, you know, work on him. That didn't bother him. It did not bother him. He was focused on something. He was an upset person.
Well, I think we were lucky to have both of them.
Yes, in a way, the...
The overall way.
Oh, yeah. No, and from that point of view, I think I have to, with all the problems we sometimes would have with Johnny on arguments, criticism, the fact is that he tolerated people of varying different points of view, and even though it could produce very extreme conflict with him. For example, some of those cabinet meetings he had were unbelievable. I mean, if someone recorded them, they wouldn't believe it would go on. There wasn't a yes man in the group, for example. And some of these meetings became absolutely turbulent. Herb Weising was sitting me when Alec approached differently, didn't want Herb in the meetings that Johnny wanted, because even though he and Toll were at times absolutely diametrically opposed on any number of things, the whole question of DOD research during the crisis. I mean, Herb was absolutely opposed to it. Johnny was all for it. And there would be meetings where they would...